Welcome, listener, to The Deep Dive. Today, we're really diving into something that, well, touches all of our lives. Personal technology. It's, you know, it's more than just the shiny gadgets. We're going to talk about the surprising challenges, maybe some hidden pitfalls, and yeah, the incredible opportunities too in this digital world of ours. So our mission today, let's cut through the noise. We want to give you a real shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about, like, practical tech issues, cybersecurity, digital well-being. Even where AI is heading, we'll be pulling out the key stuff from a really fascinating chat with a tech expert to give you a clear picture.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating, I think, is how much of what we just assume about tech, like how companies talk to us or how information gets around, it's not always the full picture, is it? We'll try to unpack some of those common misunderstandings and share some, you know, concrete actionable advice, things you can actually use to navigate this pretty complex landscape.
Okay, let's dive in. Beyond the usual, like, broken screens or batteries dying. What's the most common, maybe the most insidious tech problem you see people dealing with right now?
Honestly, the biggest thing I see day to day is malware removal and dealing with this huge array of really creative scams. They're designed to, like, superficially lock down someone's computer, make them panic. It almost always needs a significant cleanup afterwards.
That makes sense. It feels pervasive. My my mother-in-law recently mentioned some kind of Microsoft Windows notice. Are those pop-ups a really common tactic?
Oh, absolutely. That Microsoft Windows Defender pop-up, that's, like, scam number one.
Yeah.
It flashes this message saying, you know, your computer's infected, call this number immediately. Often it's a 1-833 number, totally random origin. And the thing is, Microsoft just doesn't do that. They don't communicate with customers that way. But unfortunately, a lot of people, maybe especially older generations, they're kind of more inclined to believe it. Different expectations of customer service, maybe. Microsoft, realistically, they don't really want to talk to you. They want you to buy the product and, well, figure out the fixes yourself using their online guides.
Okay, here's where it gets maybe even trickier.
Yeah.
What about ads on social media? Stuff that looks like, say, a system notification.
Yep, that's another huge one. Especially on Facebook, I see it a lot. Scammers make these ads that look exactly like a Messenger notification, you know, top right corner of the screen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. People click it, think, oh, new message, but nope. Straight into a trap. And honestly, they can be surprisingly hard to spot if you're not, like, super vigilant.
So, okay, someone falls for it. They click the ad or the pop-up and they call the number. What happens then?
Well, first off, you get connected really fast, which kind of makes it feel legitimate, you know, in a loose sense. They'll answer claiming to be whoever you think you called, Microsoft, McAfee, whatever the scam was based on. And their main goal, it's always to remote onto your computer.
Okay. The remote access.
Exactly. They'll walk you through installing a program, maybe AnyDesk, TeamViewer, or something like that, and giving them control. Once they're in, they start showing you things that look really concerning, like the Windows Event Viewer.
Which sounds important.
It does. But look, Windows is constantly logging routine stuff in there. Background processes, minor hiccups, totally normal. But they present these, you know, administrative events as severe problems. Oh, no, this needs fixing right away. They might even create fake documents right there on your desktop with, like, pricing info. Could be $100, $300, sometimes $500, even $1,000. Or show fake antivirus scans finding hundreds of threats. They're really, really good at social engineering, making you believe they're actually helping you out.
That sounds terrifyingly effective. So what's the fallout for the person who gets caught in this?
Yeah, it's rough. Many people do end up giving them money, credit cards, bank transfers, and then later they realize it was a scam, so they have to scramble to shut down bank accounts, change passwords, and then, you know, seek actual professional help for the cleanup. That cleanup process, it involves multi-layered scans, antivirus, anti-malware, anti-spyware. You need them all. Plus, removing the remote access programs, which aren't malicious themselves, but were used maliciously, right? Yeah. And then often cleaning up OS corruption they might have caused, optimizing the system. Usually it takes about a workday to sort it all out properly.
Okay. Connecting this to the bigger picture. How do we pick the right tools to protect ourselves before this happens, especially antivirus software? It's a crowded market.
It really is. Two big names I generally tell people to avoid are McAfee and Norton.
Really? Those are huge names.
I know, but often they act more like, well, almost like malware themselves. They can really bog down your system. And there's a suspicion, honestly, given their kind of predatory marketing, always finding more and more threats that they might actually be selling your information. It's hard to prove, but the behavior is questionable.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a statement. So if not them, what do you recommend? You mentioned a different solution earlier.
Yeah, Malwarebytes. It's a really effective, very lightweight solution. They're a newer company based in the Netherlands. What I like is they're super responsive and their product is excellent at digging out hidden threats, little things maybe lurking in the registry.
The registry, okay. That's deep in the system.
Exactly. Stuff other, even professional AV software might just miss. It also flags what they call PUPs, potentially unwanted programs, like some HP software that collects way too much data analytics, usage info, constantly sending stuff out. It's not strictly malicious, maybe, but you probably don't want it running. Malwarebytes flags that kind of thing.
What about Microsoft's own tool, Windows Defender? It's built in. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good on paper.
Okay. Look, Windows Defender is probably good enough if you're someone who's already really savvy online.
Yeah.
You know what not to click. You're careful about downloads. It catches a lot of the obvious stuff.
No.
But it doesn't always do a great job with the processes a program might run after it's installed, the sneaky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So for the, you know, the average user, the layman, Windows Defender alone probably isn't ideal. It's a baseline, maybe. And it kind of raises that question, doesn't it? If you don't pay for the product, you are the product.
Right.
Malwarebytes charges a little bit, which, you know, suggests they're focused on providing a service, not selling your data. You kind of hope they keep that startup mindset, right? Wanting to build the best thing, unlike some of the older giants.
Okay, moving beyond stuff we click on, what about threats that feel totally out of our hands? Like, data breaches at big companies.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one. Our personal info might be leaked way more often than we even realize. Think about call centers for a minute. Often staffed by, you know, younger people, maybe minimal training. But they have access to really sensitive data.
Like financial records, social security number.
Exactly. Card info, everything. And if you have an employee there with, say, poor impulse control, maybe an addiction,
mm-hmm.
there's a real risk there, an internal threat. And it's so common now, isn't it? Getting those letters, dear customer, our systems were compromised.
Ugh, yes.
Yeah.
Your information has probably been accessed.
Right. And what's the usual solution they offer? Like 6 months of free credit monitoring?
Yeah, it feels inadequate.
Totally inadequate. It highlights this massive lack of accountability, doesn't it? It's like getting a coupon for an ice cream cone from some multi-million dollar company after your most vital information is out there. It shows a systemic weakness, really.
Switching gears a bit.
Mm-hmm.
How is all this tech dependence affecting us? Our well-being, our basic human connection?
It's kind of surprising, actually, how forthcoming people are with really personal stuff when they're getting devices fixed. You realize their phone or tablet, it's like their whole life in one little box, you know? And
yeah.
You see this whole spectrum. On one end, maybe acute paranoia, people misinterpreting basic tech logs as something sinister. On the other end, just this almost total dependency. People needing their phone for absolutely everything. Like they'd sooner turn back home for a forgotten phone than a forgotten wallet because, well, the wallet stuff is in the phone now. And
that dependency, it sounds intense. How does that constant online engagement, maybe especially for younger people, actually change how we interact?
Yeah.
Face to face.
Well, being chronically online, just constantly scrolling social media, it seems to have really degraded regular conversation skills for some. And the ease of getting attention online, likes and shares, it fosters this kind of parasocial behavior.
Where are we social?
Yeah, where you feel this one-sided connection to someone online, like a celebrity or influencer, based only on their online persona, mistaking it for a real relationship or genuine personality. And that can feed into this chronically online crippling loneliness, feeling isolated even when you're physically around family or friends. It reminds me of that old idea, mean world syndrome, from sociology back in the 70s.
Yeah.
The more TV news people watched back then, the scarier and more dangerous they perceived the actual world to be. Online, it's like that, but amplified. Doom scrolling. Just constantly feeding your brain perceived threats, bad news, arguments, disasters. It leads to chronic stress. That feeling of amygdala hijacking your brain's threat detector is just constantly firing, fight or flight, all the time. That almost seems to be the entire premise of some social media platforms now. Like, if you get rid of something like Twitter or X, you notice a real difference. The algorithms often seem designed to feed you stuff that makes you angry, that provokes that fight or flight response.
So given how wired in we are,
What
about the everyday frustrations? Just trying to get basic tech help or deal with companies.
Oh, yeah. A huge one is just trying to reach customer support based in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So many companies outsource for, well, cheap labor. It can be incredibly difficult to get someone local. And then there's the automated phone systems, right? The endless directories. Press one for sales, press two for...
Okay. The phone tree maze. Is there any way to hack those things to get to a human faster?
Sometimes. You can try just repeatedly pressing zero, like mash the zero button.
Okay.
Or just keep saying representative, loudly and clearly. Representative. Usually by the third try, the system gives up and connects you. And look, here's a crucial thing. When you do get through, be kind to the customer service person, please. They're often working for minimum wage, they're doing their best, and they are absolutely not responsible for the company's bad policies or clunky tech.
Right. Don't shoot the messenger.
Exactly. Don't shoot the messenger. I remember trying to set up my own internet once. It took an hour and a half. Holds, system glitches. I was getting so annoyed. But I had to consciously manage my tone, you know? It wasn't the rep's fault. Think about it. The average time just to fix a simple billing error, it can easily be 45 minutes. And most of that is just waiting on hold. It's maddening.
It really does feel like navigating a digital maze sometimes, doesn't it? Uh-huh. That relief when you finally hear a human voice is huge. Patience is definitely key. Okay, let's pivot to some practical solutions. Passwords. Everyone struggles with passwords, right? Young, old, doesn't matter. Any simple, really effective advice?
Honestly, my best advice is write it down.
Write it down, like physically?
Yep. Pen and paper. It's actually one of the most secure ways to store your passwords and account info. It's tried and true. It's offline. Hackers can't digitally compromise a notebook in your desk drawer, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've actually started selling little password booklets again in our shop because people asked for them.
That's fascinating. It feels counterintuitive, but it makes sense, the physical barrier.
Exactly. It's impervious to digital attacks, which brings up digital password managers, you know?
Yeah, things like LastPass or 1Password.
Right. They're convenient, sure. But think about it. Their central databases are like giant honeypots for hackers, prime targets. If one of those gets breached, criminals could potentially get access to everything. Medical records, loans, bank accounts. If you are going to use one, try to find one that stores your data locally on your computer, not just in their cloud. It
right.
minimizes that central point of failure.
It's just the sheer number of accounts we have now. And they all want different things. Symbols, special characters, minimum lengths. It's so hard to keep track of unique, strong ones.
It is. One strategy, maybe. Use a base password you can remember. Something solid. Then adapt it for each different service using your own consistent pattern. Like add the first and last letter of the website name, or always put a specific symbol at the end for banking sites.
Yeah.
Your own personal encryption. The thinking is, if you barely know your password because of your system, how is anyone else going to guess it?
Okay, moving beyond passwords, navigating the web itself. How do we tell what's real from what's fake?
Yeah.
Especially now with AI getting so good at creating misinformation.
Yeah, that's a huge challenge. The number one rule, never, ever get your primary news or critical updates only from social media.
Just don't rely on the feed.
Right. It's often full of stuff that's just not real or heavily spun. And the AI stuff, it's getting incredibly sophisticated. It's actually fascinating in a scary way. For instance, there was a thing recently, an AI-generated voice sounded exactly like a well-known CNN reporter. And it was making this completely bogus claim about a new law, something like 5-year relationships automatically become legal marriages. Totally false. But the key giveaway, there was no video of the actual reporter speaking. It was just the voice laid over random, unrelated video clips.
Ah, so the lack of visual confirmation was the clue.
Exactly. It really puts the burden of proof, the ethical responsibility squarely on us, the individual, to verify information.
That sounds like a whole new level of difficulty. How do we actually do that verification in real time, beyond just Googling it? How do we spot those sophisticated fakes?
Well, Googling is the first step, for sure. But don't just click the top result. Look for multiple reputable news sources confirming or debunking the claim, not just blogs or random websites. Established journalism outlets. You can also try using AI tools themselves, like ChatGPT. Ask it to pull info from different places and verify a specific fact. But, and this is crucial, always cross-reference what the AI tells you with trusted human-verified sources. Don't take the AI's word as gospel.
Okay, broadening out again. AI tools. What are you seeing in terms of early adoption? How are people actually using things like ChatGPT day-to-day?
It's still really early days, I think. But it's definitely proving to be a powerful tool, especially for compiling and simplifying complex information. A lot of people aren't using AI to, like, write whole essays for them. Not yet, anyway. They're using it more to spark their own creativity. generate ideas for, say, creative writing or marketing copy or even just brainstorming. I actually used ChatGPT myself recently to brainstorm ideas for a video game guide I was stuck on, just to get the ball rolling.
That makes sense. So using AI, how does that interact with our own skills, especially writing or communication? Does it help or hurt?
That's the interesting question, isn't it? AI can sometimes strip the personality out of writing, which might be fine for like a technical manual.
Sure.
But using it really effectively requires learning prompt engineering.
Prompt engineering.
Yeah, it's basically the skill of writing really clear, detailed instructions for the AI to get the output you actually want. You see those amazing AI-generated images online. The people creating those often use incredibly long, super specific prompts, describing every little detail. And in a way, learning to prompt AI effectively can actually improve your own communication skills. It forces you to be concise, precise, to really articulate exactly what you mean.
Yeah, interesting take.
The goal should be, I think, to learn from what you're putting into it, not just passively consume what you get out of it. Don't just defer your thinking or writing skills to the machine.
Okay, final area. Looking at the community, at everyday tech users,
yeah,
are there any big gaps you see in digital literacy? Or access, maybe surprising ones. And related to that, do you see a future where traditional computers like laptops become less common for the average person?
Yeah, definitely see some gaps. One is that if you don't use it, you lose it thing. People retire, stop using tech regularly for work, and their skills can atrophy pretty quickly. But maybe surprisingly, some younger folks aren't super tech-versed either, like people in construction, maybe. Their phone does pretty much everything they need, so they might not be that familiar with laptops or more complex software. And yes, absolutely. I definitely see a trend of people downsizing from laptops. For a lot of people, their phone may be supplemented by a tablet or even a handheld gaming thing like a Nintendo Switch for entertainment. Oh, that's enough. Email, browsing, paying bills. You can do most of that on a phone or tablet now. So for many, there's just less need for a full laptop. That often changes if they go to college, of course. Then they usually need one. But for day-to-day life, less so than before.
Wow. Okay, so today we've taken a real deep dive, haven't we, into this whole landscape of personal technology, from fighting off those deceptive scams and navigating tricky customer service, to understanding the subtle ways it affects our well-being, and even how to start using powerful new tools like AI.
Yeah, and hopefully we've shown that understanding the why behind these things, not just the what, really empowers us, you know, to be safer, smarter, maybe a bit more balanced in our digital lives.
It really feels like this deep dive showed that technology, while it brings amazing convenience, it also really demands our vigilance, doesn't it? Our critical thinking, just thoughtful engagement. It's about being prepared, being informed, and being intentional with how we use these tools. So thinking about everything we covered, what's one practical step, one insight from this deep dive that you, listener, can maybe take away and apply this week in your own digital life?
Maybe it's as simple as taking that extra beat, that extra moment to verify something you see online before you share it or believe it. Or perhaps it's just stepping back and considering, you know, are you really benefiting from every single interaction you have with your devices each day? Pushing towards maybe a bit more mindfulness there.
Great thoughts. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We really hope this conversation has given you some valuable nuggets of knowledge to be even more well-informed, more empowered in your own tech-filled world.